Today, helping us better understand what we can do will be a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Ethical Globalization, Climate Change, and Human Rights. My guest is Mary Robinson. She was the first woman president of Ireland. Afterwards, she was the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights until 2004, a role that characterized her lifelong commitment to human rights advocacy. She's currently the president of the organization known as Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative, whose supporters include Jimmy Carter and Desmond Tutu. Now, Realizing Rights is dedicated to putting human rights standards at the heart of global governance and policymaking, including healthcare, earth changes, such as those associated with climate change and migration from the developing world, and women's rights and women's leadership. She has degrees from Trinity College and Harvard Law School. She served as law professor and a chancellor for the prestigious Trinity College in Dublin, as a legislator and as a barrister in the United Kingdom. She's received numerous acknowledgments and awards, and she's the former chair and counsel of Women the World Leaders and vice president of the Club of Madrid. And she is also the author of Realizing the Right to Health. Just a few details. Today, globalization seems to be a given. Back in the 1990s, there was still the view, I believe, that globalization could be thwarted, or at least the question was open for debate, since there was a large civil social movement voicing its objections to this modern phenomena. The anti-globalist, of which I am one, and others such as Benjamin Barber and Walden Bellow and David Corden and Vandana Shiva, all of whom appeared regularly on this program, stood opposed to the pro-corporate, pro-multilateral globalist who followed the thought of Samuel Huntington and Francis Fukuyama and the Friedmans, Thomas and Milton, who supported the multilateral agencies, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, which were perceived as the harbingers of the globalization's worst qualities. However, after the declaration of war on terror, it appeared that the anti-globalization movement lost its steam. And now, in 2009, globalization is a fact of life. In fact, perhaps, as some have argued, we should no longer use the term globalization because our world is now in a state of globalization. Yet the detrimental effects that the anti-globalists warned about still remain with us, and there are now seemingly new threats that your organization, Realizing Rights, has been focused upon that the average American is clueless on. Also, as we are witnessing with the global financial meltdown, the financial industry and major private multinational banks have been playing a crucial role behind globalization, which has not really earmarked accurately any of this back when it started. So I would appreciate you first giving us a brief overview and definition of the most salient features of globalization today, then walk us through, since there's no commercials in this program, what the main issues are behind ethical globalization. And I welcome you again, Mary Robbins, to our program.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm very happy to take part in your program because it does raise the very issues that we need to think about. Most people, I think, when we hear the word globalization, actually are thinking about economic globalization, you know, what's happening in the financial world. And in the last decade or so, we've just seen a huge kind of financial bubble where the rich got richer, the poor and those working found that their incomes weren't improving. It was a jobless growth scenario. And that happened both within the rich and poor countries and also in countries themselves. But there are other ways in which we can look at globalization. From a human rights point of view, for me, it's also an opportunity to talk about the globalization of values. Just over 60 years ago, some very courageous, far-sighted people came together in 1948 on the 10th of December under the leadership of an American woman, Eleanor Roosevelt, and gave us the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And most every government has ratified some of the human rights instruments. So we kind of have a global set of values, but they're not being implemented properly, and we're not holding governments to account enough. And now we have a global threat, which is the threat of the warming that's taking place through greenhouse gas emissions. And I hope we'll come back to that. But, you know, it's a very real factor because, in fact, we are in the process potentially of destroying the planet itself. I will have 4 grandchildren. I hope I'll have more in the future, but at least I have 4 now who will be in their 40s in 2050. Everything I read about global warming and the predictions doesn't give me any comfort at all because we're not actually going to stay below the 2 degrees Celsius that the G8 meeting in Italy very recently committed to. But they're not, you know, giving the leadership that will bring us there. So there are so many issues that we can talk about when we talk about globalization. When I finished my term as United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, I took that on immediately after the honor of being elected the first woman president of Ireland. I went with great hopes and great intentions to Geneva, but I found that the office of the United Nations for Human Rights was very small, it was depressed, it didn't have resources, so I had a lot to do. But it did give me that global perspective, and I think I'm still benefiting from that in a way. What we need is greater accountability of governments for what they've committed to, and we need to realize that in the 21st century, it's not just governments that have to respect human rights. In fact, the small organization, small flexible organization that I have the honor to lead at the moment, which is a lot of fun actually, because we are flexible, we can catalyze, we can convene, we can try and be pioneering in the way we're talking about human rights. We're talking not just about civil and political rights, like no torture and closing Guantanamo Bay and having security of life for people and fair justice, etc. We're also talking about rights to food and safe water and sanitation and health and education, which are so important to the poorest countries. But I think what we're really saying is we need to hold governments, but also all of those who exercise power. And therefore, a lot of the work we've been doing has been trying to say to multinational corporations, you have a responsibility to respect human rights. And there's a lot of work going on under a mandate of the United Nations held by Professor John Ruggie to say that all corporations must respect all human rights and that governments must protect their people from exploitative tendencies of large corporations that don't respect human rights, whether it's extractive industries destroying the habitats of indigenous peoples or polluting environments, etc. All of that is now coming under human rights.
I appreciate your overview. Let us now go to something that's germane and very current, and I'll give you just a little larger canvas to work on. It'll just take a moment. Today, Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State from the United States, was in India and talking about cooperative projects. What was not discussed at all or even mentioned with the mainstream media, that virtually all of these discussions hinge upon companies such as Monsanto bringing in genetically engineered or Terminator seeds, where they alone own the patent to the seed and you can only plant it once. These are frequently high water requiring seeds. There is also a major movement to get people in India into the major cities. Now, if you've been in Mumbai, if you've been in some of the other major cities, you would say, why in the world, when you have no legitimately functioning infrastructure for migrants coming in, would you want this? And yet there's been an enormous amount of behind-the-scenes land grabbing by multinational corporations in India to use as a basis for their exploitation of whether it is a mineral or a gas or something else that they can find value in, some commodity. So on the one hand, India has great wealth and has one of the largest educated middle classes, upper middle classes in the world, over 235 million individuals, but it still has over 900 million poor people. Similarly, no discussion right now has been taking place in India, or no implementation of how they can actually restart from scratch and say, how do we protect our rivers? How do we get healthier or clean water to the people? How do we support a return to biodiverse agriculture and get people out of the crowded slums of the cities? How do we build infrastructure that's sustainable for them? None of that is being talked about, just growth. And the growth in India means market share and profit. It does not mean, as it doesn't in the United States, looking at what we were in 1950, 27% of our gross domestic product came from manufacturing. Today it's down to 14%, yet the financial sector is now 20%. And then you go to China, my second point. China had the largest single burst of growth in the world for the last 7 years, and yet with 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world in China, the average person may name two, they forgot to do things such as, do we have enough water? The answer is no. Do we have proper sanitation? The answer is no. Have we done anything about the desertification of China, where now one-fifth of the landmass of China is now desert and it's increasing? The answer is no. Have we done anything about cleaning up the water that's in China? No. And by becoming more diversified in our food? No. Have we changed the way we eat, being less reliant upon animal proteins, which added the carbon footprint, and more upon vegetables and locally grown? The answer is no. So on the one hand, nobody wants to say no to either China or India because the enormous amount of potential marketing that can go on there, and all the while the poor getting poorer. But poor in China and poor in India are a lot different than poor in Ireland or poor in the United States. So would you address those two issues of what the public sees and what is going on at the heart of the matter behind the scenes, and how both countries, representing the two largest populations in the world, between them 2.5 billion people, and yet they have no long-term sustainable programs in place. Your thoughts, please.
Well, thank you, Gary. You've raised a lot of issues there about two countries that I have a huge interest in, we all have, because of their importance to the world today. And I accept a lot of the issues that you raised. First of all, in relation to India, I was for a number of years the chair of the board of the Fund for Global Human Rights out of Washington, D.C. I'm now the honorary president of the fund, and we have funded local groups in India who have combated some of the problems that you talked about. I also, as an elder, admire hugely a fellow elder, Ila Bhatt, who founded the Self-Employed Women's Association. And I've learned from her of the extraordinary role being played by women in the informal sector, particularly in large cities and in slum areas, that these are not sort of negative, anonymous areas. They're full of people who are extraordinarily productive, many of whom hold down two or three fragile jobs while they produce a great deal. And there is an incredible informal network. And that network now of women in the informal sector is working globally. It's linking with women in Africa, women in Latin America. And when recently in Colombia, in Latin America, there was a court victory by waste pickers, some of the poorest of the poor, against a sort of monopoly enterprise that was trying to harness this for purely capitalist profit measures, that message went around in an email traffic that was wonderfully, empowering of very poor people. How did you do it? What did you do? Tell us more. We're waste pickers here in Asia. Tell us more. We want to know. So there is a great vitality in the urban poor, but it's also true that the rural communities are suffering greatly, and there are mass evictions, land grabs, etc., going on. I think, again, it's a question of trying to hold to accountability. One of the advantages of globalization is we can use the internet to share ways of holding those with power to accountability, and that includes cities, it includes local government, it includes corporations that are trying to maximize their profits regardless of how it impacts on people. And we just have to keep up that fight. It also is going to be increasingly important that both China and India understand that as large emerging economies with poor components of their population, they have to be involved in the particular debate, which I call a debate about climate justice. And China will have to be a very key country in that debate as well. I actually have a little bit more of a positive view on China than the one you outlined, because I'm quite impressed by the way China is understanding the importance of alternative technologies and is investing significantly. I do agree that the sort of capitalist socialist China of recent years has resulted in more of a divide than the old China under the Maoist philosophy, where in fact there was a fairer overall situation. I mean, you know, we could argue this, and I'm not being ideological about it, but that was the reality. As UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, I made 7 working visits to China, and I was worried about the divides, the economic divides that were opening up. But I'm also interested in China's capacity now to produce solutions to the global warming climate. So can I take just a minute to introduce the notion of climate justice?
Yes, of course.
Which I'm really very keen to speak about and will be increasingly speaking about. Let me begin by saying I recommend that those who are interested in talking about notions of justice read a book that's just come out by Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, called The Idea of Justice. I can't say I've fully read it yet. I got it from Amartya, who was in Dublin about a week ago, and I had the honor of giving him an honorary degree in Trinity College Dublin and got an advanced copy of his book. It doesn't talk about climate justice as such, but it talks about a theory of justice in a very broad sense. And the aim of his book is to clarify how we can proceed to address questions of enhancing justice and removing injustices, rather than having some sort of a theory of absolute justice, if you like. And that's exactly how I view climate justice. If we look at the responsibility for greenhouse gas emissions, the 50 poorest countries in the world that are very vulnerable already to negative impacts of global warming are responsible for less than 1% of these greenhouse gas emissions. The whole of Africa is responsible for about 2.8% of the current greenhouse gas emissions, and yet it's impacting severely on many African countries. So we in the rich world, the modern Ireland, United States, Europe, Korea, parts of China, parts of India that are contributing, are responsible. And we don't want to go back to a negative reparations argument. We want to look forward and say, okay, we've been talking about trying to, you know, remedy the imbalances and help developing countries and have policies of overseas development assistance. How do we really do this now? And I think we do it in a more respectful and fairer way by acknowledging that causation that we must compensate for. We must then jump to another aspect of climate justice, which is there must be a justice in enabling the poorest sections of poor countries and the poor in developing countries, in developed countries, to be able to come out of terrible poverty, but to do it with low carbon growth. And that means we have to have the fastest transfer of green technologies that the world has ever seen. Today is the 40th anniversary of man reaching the moon. My challenge would be, how quickly can we have smart green growth for the poorest parts of the world? That, for me, is infinitely more impressive than sending somebody now to Mars or some other macho individualist thing. It's most important that we have a green, smart, low-carbon growth for the poorest in the world so that we can all share this planet fairly.
I appreciate that in-depth answer. Thank you to that. I'm going to read a brief piece of just one page of an article in commondreams.org and then ask you to respond to it. And by the way, just to give you an idea, I'm a certified organic farmer, and I have a home in Florida, and in Naples, Florida. And all the houses on the property, there's a staff house and a barn, and the main house, all have solar vents on in the attic. Now, it's not expensive at all. It was about $600. And what it does, it works off the solar cells that you put on the roof, but it causes a specialized fan to go on in the attic and vent out when the temperature gets, I think it's 85 degrees, Now, under normal circumstances, that attic will get up to 150 degrees. 130 is very common. It's stifling. You can't go in that attic for more than a matter of a minute and you're soaking wet. But now, just that, nothing else, brought down the temperature in the house by about 15 degrees. It's actually cool in the house. And then, of course, growing shade plants around the house to protect it from the heat in the summer and keep it warmer in the winter. And when you think, gee whiz, this technology is green, it then requires less of an air conditioning factor, which then reduces global carbon emissions. Something that simple as solar exhaust fans in attics, because people don't realize when the heat rises, it's trapped in the attic and then dissipates back, and you could have enormous change. Think of people in Arizona, where they have to have the air conditioning on 24/7, and parts of Texas, 24/7. I've lived in Texas. I was a resident of Dallas area for about 10 years, and it gets 115 degrees in the summertime. It did when I was there, but that means inside in an attic, it's going to be a lot hotter. Simple, inexpensive technologies also are here. And one last thing, I'm a vegan. That's my choice for several reasons. But we did this science where I showed that you can grow a potato to full one and a quarter pound potato for about, the cost of that potato is about, when you grow it yourself, it's around 12 cents. But you only use about 70 gallons of water. To grow 1 pound of beef on a cow is 3,200 gallons of water. And one, you have something organic and local and creating biodiversity. The other is frequently has to be grown elsewhere or raised elsewhere. Enormous amount of natural resources then shipped in. And it's also a health detriment. And I'm looking and thinking, gee whiz, if we just all went meatless each Monday, if we just went sugar-free on Tuesday, and if you just start using the things that we could do even as we speak, it could make a difference in the countries you're talking about, the developing countries. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to what you said. Mind you, I'm talking to you from my home in the west of Ireland. I think we're more interested in wind power than the possibility of solar vents in the attic because we don't get as much sun as you're talking about.
Right.
But the point is, that we should be doing in Ireland the smart things that make sense, and every country should be doing them. And I'm really very keen, but we also must ensure that that technology is available to the parts of the world, and I'm talking about Africa, South Asia, that do have the sun. You know, there are wonderful achievements of social entrepreneurs. You can cook on waste. You can have water distillation, water desalination, projects for small hydro, projects for small solar batteries, but they're not available to the billions who are denied a power, access. In the 21st century, there are almost 2 billion people who have no access to electricity or equivalent power. And then you have women who inhale horrible smoke from firewood or kerosene, or who walk several miles every day and get raped en route and get, attacked, and who waste time as women who could be very productive. And so I very much agree with every country exploring the possibilities. And one of the principles of climate justice is each individual can do something. And I take the message from Wangari Maathai from Kenya, who won the Nobel Prize for Peace a couple of years ago for her work in greening parts of Kenya and Africa. And she has said that all of us can do three things. We can reuse, reduce, recycle. And the more we are living in a profligate world, the more we can reduce and reuse and recycle. I also take your point. My younger son is a vegan, and he's preaching to the rest of the family. I'm afraid we're not convinced yet to give up our bad habits, but I do take the message. And we are in our place here in the west of Ireland. We're growing our own potatoes now. We're growing our own cabbages. We're growing our own. And it's a very real sense. Everybody who has a little bit of land should have an allotment now. We should really change our habits, but schools need to change. Teachers need to be energized by this notion of climate justice. It's a very energizing, forward-looking concept because it's saying there is something all of us can do, but there's also a huge need to bridge the gap between the ways in which, in a way, the rich world has been inflicting, self-inflicted financial crises, et cetera, on the poorest parts of the world, but also this global warming from the greenhouse gas emissions. So we need to reduce and mitigate rapidly, but we also need to have much more emphasis on the adaptation of the poorest countries using indigenous knowledge as well as shiny new green technologies. It needs both.
I absolutely agree with that. There are many areas where corporate intrusion and domination in developing parts of the world, the ones you're speaking of, are creating far worse human rights and adverse health conditions than they did just a decade ago. For example, forcing Indian farmers to adapt genetically modified crops, especially cotton, which has been responsible for so many unnecessary suicides. And then mining conditions by the large multinational mining corporations in Africa who ignore adverse health conditions of the miners and who've been using AIDS as an excuse to get away with compensating ill miners and their families, and also continual stripping down of rainforest in Asia and Latin America and displacing people and destroying the geology and biodiversity of land, and then forcing slave labor in Chinese factories and now understand also in Africa where Chinese presence has escalated dramatically in recent years, and there are many other examples. So it would seem that we are not learning some of the lessons that you've been talking about. The lessons are good, but it's until we implement them, and shouldn't we be focusing upon holding politicians, or at least those who are in position of responsibility, holding them to a higher standard of accountability? Because otherwise, they talk nice. They'll tell you what you want to hear. Doesn't mean they're implementing it. As one example, the Amazon is dying. The Brazilian government is legalizing deforestation, and Western super brands are benefiting from it. This needs to stop, by John Savin. And he says this: Brazilian President Lula da Silva, writing in The Guardian, offered us these words of hope. No country has a larger stake in reversing the impact of global warming than Brazil. Well, that is why it is at the forefront of efforts to come up with solutions that preserve our common future. Now, as the author says, his words are fine and noble, but he's not actualizing it. For the last 10 years, Greenpeace has been working in the Amazon alongside communities to protect the rainforest. And last week, Greenpeace released a report, which was the result of a three-year investigation of the role of the cattle industry in driving illegal deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. And the report was entitled Slaughtering the Amazon, reveals that the devastating impacts cattle ranching is having on the climate and biodiversity in local communities. And cattle ranching is the biggest cause of deforestation, not only in the Amazon, but worldwide. And the report reveals that the Brazilian government is a silent partner in these crimes by providing loans to and holding shares in the three biggest players, Burton, JBC, and Marfrig, that are driving expansion into the Amazon rainforest. And so what we have is we have leaders of countries saying what the world wants to hear, and then at the same time that they're saying these things, right in clear view, multinational corporations are making deals because they see everything as a commodity. And as long as you're a commodity, someone's going to profit from it. Well, the Chinese and the Indians that are educated and earning good incomes and live in better conditions than their country persons, they want meat. They want chicken. They want the hardwood furniture. They want what everyone in the West wants. They want what you have in Northern Ireland or in Western Ireland and what we have in the United States. So it becomes a vicious circle, and it becomes one that we're not facing. I would like for you to give us your input on this, please.
Well, I'm glad, Gary, that you focused on corporate responsibility. It's something that my colleagues and I in Realizing Rights have been working on for the last 6 to 7 years, and we've been doing it by supporting the idea of holding corporations to what I call these global values that we have, that are the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the various covenants and conventions that the United States and other countries have ratified. They may not have ratified all of them, but every country, including China, including Brazil, including all the countries you could mention, have ratified some of these covenants and conventions. And the idea of corporate responsibility is to make it clear that all corporations must respect all human rights. That has been accepted in a report last June to the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. And the person who has been doing the work on this with his mandate, Professor John Ruggie, who's based in Harvard, has been fleshing out what this means, and we've been supporting his mandate. There's also the United Nations Global Compact, where some companies are voluntarily accepting the values of the Universal Declaration and not being complicit in its violation of core labor standards, environmental standards, and tackling corruption. The overall standard of the Global Compact is not very high at the moment. We want to make it stricter, but at least it's a beginning. And there are companies that are prepared to pioneer a bit. I mean, as a human rights person, I see two sides. I see that there are many violations by corporations at grassroots level, but also there are companies that are trying to set a standard, and we mustn't discourage them. If we take a totally negative attitude about corporations, we don't harness their energy to be on the side of the need to make sure that the work of corporations is respecting human rights. So in a way, there's a balance to be drawn there. You talked about the footprint now of China in Africa. I'm very conscious of that because of visiting very often, almost on a monthly basis, various parts of Africa. To some extent, the Chinese investment in Africa changed the dynamic because Africa became a place to invest in. And that, in a way, was positive because up to then, Africa had not been regarded as being a positive place to invest in. But a lot of the Chinese investment is very exploitative and selfish, because the Chinese have to learn lessons that Western colonizing countries took a long time to learn. So it's a kind of, it's interesting that they're now going through the same kind of making the maximum gains for China out of what they're doing in Africa that earlier colonial exploiters, particularly Western countries, used to do. And I speak as a country that happened to be colonized itself, so we have a little bit of a perspective. And in a way, in talking about climate justice from an Irish perspective, I'm hoping that we can be a bridge and we can actually help to address in a balanced way some of the issues that that you're rightly raising on your program. They're big issues. And we cannot totally dismiss the role of business. What we have to do is make business very accountable to the global values of human rights, of environmental concerns, and the way we can do it with the globalization of access to information and access to groups that are trying, like Greenpeace and many, many others that are trying to address these issues, is I believe we need more links between environmental activists, human rights people, development, those who are working on development. I'm honorary president of Oxfam, for example. I also work closely with Amnesty. We all need to work more intelligently together in order to hold to account those with power.
I certainly agree with that, and I believe that corporations will play a major role in helping solve these problems, especially if they see that they can gain profits and public relations panache by showing that they're on the right side of history. Yeah. Just two more issues for you. And I think this is an issue that certainly interests you. Recently, you've become especially concerned with the relationship between climate change and the various environmental and resource challenges humanity is facing and the human rights issues that you've mentioned, such as the escalation of violence or the displacement of more and more people into abject poverty. First, please identify the main issues that relate climate change with human rights issues and social justice. And secondly, gazing as best you can into the near future, where do you see human rights issues heading if nothing is done to change the global governance policies to preserve human dignity in the developing world?
There are two super questions. Do you have 4 hours? The main issues on human rights and climate change. You know, a lot of the discussion of climate change until recently has been very scientific And that's good, because we need to listen to the science. But if you look at climate change as a science problem, you're talking about seawalls and plants that can develop without much water and so on. But if you look at the human impact of climate change, it is enormous already, particularly in countries like Africa and South Asia and parts of Latin America. Huge. There is a report that was issued in London in May, the end of May, by the Global Humanitarian Forum, which I serve on the board of, called Anatomy of a Silent Crisis. And it shows the impact of climate change, the number of deaths already that can be largely attributed to the global warming, the number of people who've had to migrate already. It's predicting that by 2050 we could have between 150 and 200 million climate refugees. So these are the kind of human predictions. That's why we need to give this maximum priority in a very positive way. I believe it can be a new dynamic of development and a much more respectful one, because it takes away the idea of a them and us. What happened when we had the rich world financial crisis? Self-inflicted, we know. Selfish, self-inflicted financial crisis. Many countries cut their budget for development aid to the poorest countries, because they said we have to look after our own. If we have an intelligent response to climate change, we can't do that, because there's no them and us. If we don't have smart growth and quick transfer of green technology to the poorest countries, which is the majority world, that's where the majority of the world live, and they'll have bad, high carbon growth if they don't have access to technologies for low growth, in which case we will all have a world that my grandchildren will not survive in. It's very personal. It's very real. When you talk about human dignity, I'm very glad you mentioned that, because I took part in an exercise during the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we realized we haven't put enough emphasis on human dignity. So we now have an agenda called Protecting Dignity, an agenda for human rights. And it's a very good way of making clear that human rights does encompass the right to food and safe water and health and education and shelter. And it's a way of tackling poverty. It's a way of focusing on the most deprived. And climate justice encompasses that notion. And I think there's a huge opportunity to reach out to those who've cared about the environment, those who have your values as a vegan, and say, let's link and share the world of the commitments that governments have made. They've made very strict commitments voluntarily in the area of human rights, but they don't observe them. We need, you know, a huge constituency that says, we hold you to your commitments. We shame you if you won't keep to them. We are people power, and we demand that you live up to your, and that we have, in fact, a safe world, a sustainable world for this century.
Very, very well said. My final thought, if you could address it, please. There's certainly a correlation between the demise of natural resources and harsh climate conditions and food shortage and the lack of sufficient and appropriate health care around the world. Also, we will surely witness more rampant spread of disease throughout the developing world as environmental and living conditions worsen. How prepared are our international health agencies, such as the World Health Organization and Western governments, for tackling this problem? There are those who might suggest that diminishing world population is going to happen by this, and it will if they don't drag their feet. And I'm very concerned. Do you see any indication that we are going to get this message in time to help prevent a major crisis in human rights?
I think it's a huge problem, and it's a particularly acute one, because we are going to see, as we know, the biggest explosion in population. It's already happened to some extent, but we are going to have a 2.6 billion growth between now and 2050, up to somewhere near 9 billion. And we've already had an unprecedented growth at a time when the climatic conditions will change the health hazards. More countries will be likely to suffer from malaria attacks because of global warming, and they won't be prepared. And that is a big issue. But in a way, I'm back again to the hopeful part of globalization, access to information, access to ways of sharing good practices of what to do. I was in Rwanda, one of the poorest countries in Africa, for a conference on climate change last September, organized by the government of Rwanda and the London School of Economics. And after discussions from an African perspective, the lack of preparedness in some ways, the lack of technology transfer, we then went out into the countryside in Rwanda, and we saw two examples of what they're doing to regenerate some of the impacts of climate change. We saw a social program of intense tree growing, where families and communities locally in this poor, dry part of Rwanda were given a small amount of money to plant fast-growing trees that could be harvested after about 10 years. And if the families looked after those trees for 3 years, then they could own the trees. So there was a big self-interest. And then we looked at a lake where throughout Rwanda there's a regulation that you can't have either agricultural or human activity within 50 meters of the surroundings of a lake. And this lake, because of that, was regenerating itself. So what I learned from that is a lot of indigenous knowledge. I suppose because of my work as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, when I saw a lot of man's inhumanity, I saw it in so many places like Grozny. I was, in fact, sending a message about that very brave human rights defender who was killed, Natalia, in Chechnya recently. I knew her. She introduced me to some very, very brave witnesses to human rights violations in Grozny when I was there as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. My message is, let's see the hopeful side. You can describe, and I could do it very graphically, the dangers that we're into with global warming and emissions. We don't understand yet how grave those dangers are, but we also can do something about it. Each of us can do something. And in Rwanda, the poorest country in Africa, they're doing remarkable things. And that's the message we have to get across. You know, we can be positive. I honor the fact that you're a vegan. That's a step. I haven't been prepared to take it yet, but I'm thinking along those lines. Because we actually do need to know how we're using the resources of our land. And it has to get personal. And then we have to put pressure on politicians and on corporations and on multinational, the World Bank, IMF, they all have a role to play. And I'm very pleased that we discuss these things at some length on your program, because that doesn't often happen. It's not a soundbite program, thank God. And I wish you well in the future.
What I will do, if you're interested, I will send you a copy of my newest book, not yet published, but it's finished, called How to Be a Healthy Vegetarian. But with it, I have all the science showing in each area why vegetarianism is best, but also about 500 color photographs I've taken of showing you how exciting and interesting and delicious dishes can be. And that might inspire you.
I would appreciate that. We can use that in the west of Ireland and maybe spread the word.
One thing I'm not familiar with, maybe the people in this audience would also find this of interest. We haven't heard much about how our current economic crisis is impacting those in the west of Ireland. Could you just give us a final little touch of that?
Just briefly, it's a difficult time in Ireland. We've had our own self-inflicted problems of the Celtic Tiger getting greedy. It was a few people who got greedy, a few banks, a few lenders to people who were persuaded to take out mortgages they couldn't afford, etc. And now we have a very strict budgetary situation, so the country's a bit down because of that. But my own sense of Ireland's strength in this area of the global climate conditions is we are very close to the reality in African countries because we have such a long history of working closely with them. And I think Ireland can be a strong voice on climate justice issues. And that's going to be part of what I'll be doing when I return fully to Ireland. I'm still working out of New York with my colleagues in Realizing Rights. I happen to be here at the moment because there's a constitutional issue I've been asked to advise on as a member of the Irish Council of State. I'll be advising our second woman president, President Mary McAleese, in the coming days on two bills that she's referred, that she's considering referring to the Irish Supreme Court. And that gives me a few welcome days in my home in the west of Ireland that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But Ireland has to cope with a severe impact of a self-inflicted you know, financial crisis. So it's a little bit like the United States. It's a little bit like other European countries. And I hope we can do this in a way that we've really listened and learned the lessons.
I certainly appreciate you taking your time in a busy schedule to share your very valued insights. Thank you very much, Mary Robinson, for being with us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
A continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Ethical Globalization, Climate Change and Human Rights. You were just listening to Mary Robinson, the first woman president of Ireland, and also afterwards the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, and one of the foremost thinkers in the world.